Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 405, September the 7th, 1979, and it's side one. The past 3 weeks, we've gone into a chronology of some important dates and events, and of course, again, I apologize, this is not even the beginning or scratching the surface of the very important dates that have changed or altered our course of history in the past few years that have affected us up through the present. If those of you have the energy or the inclination or desire as you read books, articles, and magazines, take down dates from those books and just make a note of them on a piece of paper as you're reading if you think they're important, and save them, mail them to me maybe once a month, once every few months, some of these significant events, and you might just state where you got the information from so that if I want to look farther into it, I can, and you can help pool important dates with me. One of those dates I had on the August 10th tape, 1901, the Rockefeller Medical Institute. I didn't go into the Medical Institute at all, but it's just a date because I believe it was significant and affects our future today. There's a book that just came out specifically on just that subject. It's called Rockefeller Medicine Men, Medicine and Capitalism in America. It's written by E. Richard Brown, University of California, and it's $12.95. There's a review of it in the Washington Post recently calling it the Hippocratic Hypocrisy, and it mentions all the factors that people are considering in terms of health today, whether it's pregnant teenagers or smoking or jogging or vitamins, that health has become a multi-million dollar health business for the upper middle class corporate America, the upper class corporate America. And the objective of keeping people well and healing the sick has changed, according to this author, and we know this, from the art of medicine into a scientific business. There's rising costs in medicine. They're less effective than they were. There's more waste. There's incompetence. There's illegal actions and ethical behavior. And the medical industrial power base, according to this book, is based on the Rockefeller Empire from 1900 to 1930. And I have that date, 1901, as the start of the Medical Institute. And the author says that from that time on, it was when the corporation started funding, starting with $300 million into medical schools. And medical schools and science took over from the art of medicine and medical practice. In 1904, there were 166 medical schools. By 1929, another important date, because then you can look at that chronology and insert, and we'll update it all the time, they closed down to 76 medical schools. 3 women's colleges were closed, 7 black colleges. In 1873, there were 178 hospitals, but in 1909, 4,359 hospitals were put in, and disease became equivalent with something that the corporate empire should be taken care of. A man by the name of Frederick T. Gates from Minneapolis, a minister, a Baptist minister, was the guiding force, according to this author, behind the Rockefeller Medical Institute, that disease formerly used to be caused by disproportionate, unequal distribution of wealth, of bad living standards, working conditions, people alienated from their work, economic insecurity. That disease was believed earlier to be caused by those things. But when Frederick Gates began to work for the Rockefeller Institute, ignorance and crime and vice and so forth were the result of disease. They weren't the result of exploitation and poverty. It was all turned around, and the doctors began joining country clubs and went from 4,000 a year to 60,000, and now they're in the millionaire class. And according to this book, healthcare is the country's third largest industry. You know, I've mentioned on other tapes before the memos in the Howard Hughes Hotel in Mexico that said keep the Hughes medical business going, their empire, because it's the fourth largest industry. It's a toss-up, I think, whether it's oil or weapons ammunition or narcotics, and then medicine. But medicine fits in fourth. I think it's the fourth largest. This author says the third. And he goes into the construction of hospitals and the banking and the firms and the drug companies and the medical supplies and the insurance empires, even down to the flower shops and the gift shops for the sick. There's an article in the New York Post last week, surgeons prescribe 200 million in unnecessary drugs a year. Another article, the Rockefeller Fund discloses their 1978 grants. They gave $2.1 million to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where Martha Mitchell died of cancer, injected after she began to break down the links of organized crime and criminals, including her husband, to the Watergate exposés. She was injected immediately. Rockefellers also gave $10,000 to a Zen center in San Francisco. They have moved a lot of their headquarters and money to the Bay Area. And they also gave money, interesting, to a South African Institute of Race Relations in Johannesburg. Dr. Eshakoff, the doctor who ordered the cremation of Nelson Rockefeller a day before the funeral without an autopsy to see if he was murdered, was a graduate from down Johannesburg, South Africa. But the Rockefeller Fund grants also went to places like Johannesburg, South Africa, Zen centers, and I've talked a little bit about then Eastern religions and the CIA and the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. The book is called Rockefeller Medicine Men, and I think it would be interesting to read that and fit that, as I say, into the time slot of 1901 when the oil empire, the oil industry, got into the medical field. The only good book, not book, an article about the Hughes Medical Institute down in Florida came out in December of 1975. It was published by the Knight News Service, and then up till that time it was very secret, and it still is secret, and now they've opened 12 satellite hospital stations, and it's all linked to Hughes aircraft and the Central Intelligence Agency. It's a giant that is sleeping that people in this country haven't addressed themselves to. The Knight News Service had a long article on the Medical Institute, and just several weeks later, John S. Knight III was murdered. Three people entered his apartment and murdered him, and they were charged, or the allegations were, that there was kinky sex and homosexual relationships of John Knight to the people that killed him. But just coincidentally, again, and how many coincidences make a conspiracy, this person was slain in Philadelphia just weeks after the very first and the most complete expose of the Hughes Medical Institute in Miami was published by the Knight News Service, and it's the only thing we have to hold on to until somebody writes a book on the subject. But right after that, John Shively Knight was murdered. There's been a lot of news coverage on the resignation of Andy Young from the United Nations. I think Andy Young was set up. I don't think his meeting with members of the PLO is any different than Henry Kissinger and Mr. Haig and the secret team meeting in California up at Santa Rosa at the Bohemian Club, or their Bilderberger meetings and buying and selling nations out and making deals. I think it was time to unload Andy Young. I don't think he was an asset to Carter. With his, he certainly is a racist. His church doesn't allow blacks in it, and he's never resigned from there. He unloaded Mr. Lipsitch, his Jewish lawyer, and took on Mr. Cutler from the CIA in Washington. He has changed his staff, and his fascist fangs keep showing more clearly all the time. I believe Andy Young was set up and dumped out, and I think that the man behind it is Mr. Zedi Labib Terhesi. Terhesi, he pronounces his name. He's a man that has worked with the PLO since 1964, but his roots and tentacles go into Brazil and Argentine and Spain. That's where the CIA and the Nazis could set up the money and funds and keep Mr. Arafat and the various PLO persons supplied with not only their bombs, but their escapes, their various escapes from trials, and their ability to keep the terror going and demand that they have Palestine back. This Palestinian has been the active, cohesive group between the fascist elements, and he's at the United Nations there representing the PLO, and he's a man to watch because, as I've said before on other tapes, when Israel became a country in May 1948, by the summer of 48, all the top Nazis from Spain, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay had gone into Egypt with Nasser to form their plans to eradicate Israel. Reinhard Gehlen said after World War I that 20 or 30 years wasn't long to hatch another plot. Israel is doomed from all sides, and the split of blacks and Jews and Palestinians from Jews and the Third World from the Jews is inevitable. I think a lot of the fault is the part of the Israelis, and we'll do a tape on if you want me to. I think they're totally to blame for a lot that's happened, and I think their future is and always will be shaky. Whenever they have a choice to make a step, they make the wrong step, even to working with South Africa and the Shah of Iran and the Savak. Although I am Jewish, I have had no sympathy for the way Israel developed and the way the Jewish people have approached anything from the Kennedy assassination to racism to death squads to covering up various murders in this country to looking the other way to putting Nazis in high positions all around the world. The Jewish people have not been cohesive or concerned about the world in particular, and I have very little sympathy. It's like last week Mr. Newhouse died, that well-known publisher who owned so many newspapers around the country, including the New Orleans State's Item, at a time when Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, was trying to expose Clay Shaw, a member of Nazi Permindex organization, the International Trademark, and so forth. He got nothing but misrepresentation and innuendos and smearing for the New Orleans State's Items. Jewish newspapers would put down a man exposing a hardcore Nazi such as Clay Shaw and have a policy across the boards. The media predominantly or a large part in the hands of Jewish people in New York City, CBS, NBC, ABC, will not allow the truth to be told, even though eventually countries like Israel will be wiped out and Jews around the world could be liquidated. They've played a deathly game of helping the assassins and silence, and I have no sympathy. And history could put all the pieces together if they wanted, and they don't want. And therefore, the whole flack of the UN between Andy Young and the Jews and blacks is just some more window dressing for a bloodbath that has to take place in the Middle East eventually. Mr. Brzezinski and company have to escalate the Cold War by taking the Bolshoi Ballet at a time when they were in New York City giving their concerts, and they were to go to Chicago and Los Angeles from there and have one of the men defect just at that time. If he wanted to defect and he'd been planning it for 4 years, they could have had a successful concert and danced through the United States as planned, not affect the morale of the troop, and then before departing for the Soviet Union when the tour is over and completed, stay in this country. No, there had to be that stigma and the assistance. And again, Jimmy Carter was close to the defection, sitting at the telephones and so forth. We were at the Bolshoi Ballet at Lincoln Center last week ago, Friday night, and the concert was put off for 45 minutes because the director of the ballet always sits in the audience at the time, and he was out at the airport with the ballerina, and they had stopped her departure, and they announced 40 minutes later that he telephoned that we could see the ballet without him, and then he appeared during the second act. They had the lights and introduced him. I saw the ballet, The Legend of Love. I don't know whether the defection was affecting the troop or whether I was spaced out and missed something about it, but I used to be very thrilled by the Royal Ballet and the Bolshoi Ballet. I've seen them before, and I was left somewhat detached and a little bit cold by the whole thing. I don't know whether it was the mood of the defection that was coming through or not. It must have affected the troop, I'm sure. One point I want to make is that when I'm on vacations, if I don't give you my address or my telephone number, I have a reason I don't. Those of you that have tapes 360 and 361 I made a year ago of things that happened to our family, I could update that, but I just might give you one incident. I stayed with friends in New York City, and I don't allow anybody in their house except to go to the door to leave us off or pick us up, and I use a third person for phone number to reach me, but I would call in there. I do that so that in case anything happens to the family or anything unusual happens, it can't be blamed upon our having visited there. The Friday before we left, the housekeeper was in the living room looking out the window in the backyard, looking down the window, and a man came through the door, and both doors were shut. They have double locks, like the apartments in New York City, you know how they're bolted up. They didn't have bolts on, but they have two locks, two double locks, and the front door was closed tight. And the housekeeper was in the back of the living room, and this man came through the front hall, went through the living room, and went up to meet her halfway into the house. And he was blonde, about 35 years old, and he was holding a briefcase. And she freaked out because in the 20 years that she's worked there, nobody has ever gotten through the doors or come in this way. And she was home alone. She thought he was going to pull a gun or tie her. He didn't. And she just went up to him and said, "You have the wrong address. You want such and such a number." And she gave him a number down the street, like 1112 or something. She just said some number. "You want this number." And he looked at her and he said, "Well, they sent us here from California." And she just escorted him to the door. He didn't do anything to her. He just walked out, and the doors were locked again. And she looked out the kitchen window, and there were about six people in the car out in front, and they were looking up. There was a car out there waiting for him. There's no parking on that street, or cars are towed away. There were some women and a couple of men, and they were just looking up at the house, and she never heard any more about it. But just the California thing would make my friends, you know, take a second look, or myself. Outside of that, only one other incident happened, the same thing that happened last time I was in New York, only this was in L.A. We left Kennedy Airport and flew to L.A., stayed there 2 days, then I boarded the plane, or was going to board. Our tickets were all printed to go from Los Angeles to Monterey, the names, my daughters and myself. We checked through, the two girls checked through, and they had reservations for 10 in the morning, 10:15. They said to me, even though it was print on the ticket, I was on the same flight with them, they said, "No, your plane has been changed till the evening flight, 8:40, which means I'd have to sit around the airport for 10 hours. There's no other flight to Monterey, only United, and it comes 10 hours apart. And somebody evidently had called and changed my flight to an evening flight, which means I'd have to sit around the airport. And I didn't panic or get angry, and I bring books and writing material. And they said, "You wait on a standby." And they set my ticket down at the desk upstairs where you board the plane. That's where they kept us. Downstairs, we checked luggage through and everything. Then the girls went on the plane, and they had my ticket sitting on a table, and they had written on the top of it, E15. When everyone was bored and I was the last one on, they said, "Here's your ticket." And he hadn't written anything else on it. Now, if seat E15 was vacant, why didn't I just board with the girls? And it turned out there were empty seats on the plane. It wasn't sold out. But they had me designated to a specific seat. In that case, when they pass coffee or fruit juice or whatever, I don't take anything on the flight, because I think that being specified in one particular seat, there may be something in there that might affect my mind or behavior or state of mind, so I just don't take anything served me. But it was already written there where I was to sit. I don't know why. Nobody next to me made any conversation. I didn't talk with anybody. But I sat separately from the girls and at my own place. But for a while, when they boarded, I didn't know whether I'd have to sit at the airport for 10 hours. That happened last time I was in New York several years ago. I checked through downstairs, the luggage checked through, and everything was fine. When I went to board, they said my ticket had been canceled. And, of course, there was that's another long story. I might have had that on that other tape for you. 4 hours later, I got a plane to California. So those are the only two incidences. We came home safe and alive, but it always bothers me because I don't have friends who have the same experiences, and if you've had it, any of you write to me and tell me about it, and we still don't know how this party got in the house or what they were doing. But in case you wonder why I don't give you the phone number or why I don't give you the address of where I'm staying, it's just for that reason, so that I can tell the people that if anything happens, nobody that I know knows where I am. And if I visit various cities and visit your homes, I would do the same thing with you, and I don't give people the number of where I stay or the address, and that's only between us. Reverend Bernard T. Pagano was freed from the Delaware jails. He's a man who has a degree in psychology, who refers to himself as a maverick, who has released people from police authority before. He works in the Roman Catholic Chapel at the Delaware State Mental Hospital and for the police department in Delaware. and he's been instrumental in freeing various inmates and helping people that were in police custody. The police appreciated it so much that they evidently trumped up charges and identified him as being responsible for holdups in the area. He had counseled blacks, whites, Hispanics, and other people over police work that had happened. And now he could identify with the impoverished and so forth because he became a victim. Finally, a gentleman, a post office clerk from Pennsylvania, admitted that he had been doing these robberies and not Pagano. I wonder about the Pennsylvania connections or why someone from Pennsylvania went down to Delaware to do these things. But it seems that they were out to get Reverend Pagano and caused him a great deal of distress and problems with the lineup and evidence. And when he would tell them that he was somewhere else, the police never checked it out. They had a reason to get him. And even if you're innocent, you can pay a fortune in lawyers' cases, in losing your job, in anxiety, clearing your reputation, and so forth. They gave him a hard time, and if somebody hadn't come forward, he might have still been charged with the crime. You see, the evidence of a person's guilt is the most important thing to hold on to, but the police can send you to jail on the flimsiest evidence. They can say that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Kennedy without a shred of evidence, ballistics or fingerprints or identification being at the scene or the trajectory matching where he was located and so forth. The evidence in conspiracies is completely fouled up, and it's fouled up at the lowest levels with the police, the district attorney, the defense attorney sometimes, the local courts, and very many good innocent people are locked away on just the flimsiest of evidence because the police said so. Luckily, Reverend Pagano is released, and he has more to say about the police and mental hospitals after that experience. And I think we always have to be alert to each individual case, which I've tried to be in California or in other states where the evidence comes in, and add up how common this is, because those people that are trying to affect social change are either murdered or framed so that they no longer can effect these changes in their own immediate society. There was an interesting death, murder, suicide in California, August the 15th, 1979, written up not in the Associated Press, the United Press, I haven't seen it over the wire services, a man named Roy William Dale, long articles from the Santa Rosa Press, Santa Rosa, California, the Press Democrat. Now, Santa Rosa is where the Bohemian Club is, where our great conspirators on a worldwide basis have their little summer frolics in the woods. Heterosexual and homosexual heads of states put on their little shows for each other. It's the home of former SLA member Stephen Weed, of SLA member Nancy Ling Perry. It's close to the Jonestown headquarters in Ukiah and Redwood City. Roy William Dale, according to the sheriffs there, died from what they call unexplained circumstances. So they just call it a suicide, even though there is much to explain about this particular murder. On the dashboard of his car was a note written linking him to the assassination of John Kennedy, and it suggests that he's down, one down and two to go, that he's part of a murder trio to be killed, linking it to the big H, which would be H.L. Hunt, the oil man. Now, that's interesting because Mark Lane's book, Executive Action, in the movie, has the final orders for the killing of John Kennedy by this rich oil man that's supposed to be H.L. Hunt. But we know that Mr. Hunt doesn't run Bethesda or the autopsies and the teams in the National Archives that got rid of the bullets and the amount of bullets in John Connally and John Kennedy, or the testing of these bullets, the neutron activation test. And we know that H.L. Hunt doesn't control the National Archives or Earl Warren locking up information for 75 years. This is one of these simplistic explanations of the ordering of the Kennedy killing done in Mark Lane's movie and book with Don Freed, Executive Action. And the note written, found on the dashboard, was by a third person. Imagine they're calling this suicide, and they haven't linked the handwriting or the ink to Mr. Roy William Dale. But on the dashboard of the car was this note saying, a few more to go, and that he was a part of the Kennedy assassination. He supposedly got a phone call. He lived in Orange County, California. And after he got the phone call, 2 minutes later, he dropped out of sight. Now, nobody says who was in the room or heard the phone call, but he did receive a telephone call. They know that much. And then he disappeared without any trace. He was 47 years old, took a car up from Orange County, and went to Sonoma County and was found in a parked car. His hands were tied behind his back. This is another John Roselli, John Paisley suicide. His hands were tied behind his back. His feet were tied. One hand, left hand, was tied very, very tight. The right one was possibly loose enough to tie the other up behind his back. Imagine that one. The car was parked a half a mile off of Highway 1, and the windows were taped inside and out. So you have a note that they can't prove that he wrote, taping from the outside of the car, both hands and feet tied down, and then there's a dust cover over the car. This has to be the greatest Houdini suicide of all. And then there were two empty bottles of Anacin, the size that would hold 200 tablets of Anacin, but the autopsy doesn't indicate that this was in his stomach. And on the dashboard, as I say, was this note, 3 down and 1 to go, dated 1962, the assassination of John Kennedy. So somebody has got the year wrong, but has tried to link his death to John Kennedy's assassination. Now, the sheriffs in Santa Rosa, according to the article, the August 16th, notified the federal authorities of this death and the note, but as of that date, in quotes, they weren't interested. They weren't in the case. They're just bubbling with curiosity. And, of course, this is an international incident. The man is a native of England. He moved here from England, but the federal authorities aren't interested. As a native of England, and he came later to this country, in 1962, I think of Albert Osborne, another researcher who sent me one of these articles, thought of Albert Osborne, the man who sat on the bus going to Mexico City with Lee Harvey Oswald and then went to England right after the time that Kennedy was assassinated and then returned down to Mexico. He was part of that assassination team that then moved from Mexico down to Chile, where they were already organized down there with their own team since World War II. Also, Treason for My Daily Bread talks about Zed, and another listener was concerned also about, was this Zed that was murdered? But I don't believe that Zed was living in Orange County all these years. The man who allegedly did the fatal headshot was in Lebanon and in the Middle East, and I don't see any reason why Zed would be living in Orange County unless he was a zombie that they could control in some way, because that book was written at a time that this man was living in Orange County. There is no information, according to the sheriffs, to show that he was ever in Texas or New Orleans. Well, you don't have to be part of the assassination teams to be in New Orleans. Part of the assassination teams with Carlos Marcello and David Ferry and Martin Borman's team from Chile were in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. There's no reason to say that New Orleans is the only city you can be in to be part of the assassination teams. He could have been part of the Chicago team that was going to kill Kennedy. He could have been part of the Miami team. But they limit a certain city and say, well, if he didn't come from there, it couldn't be linked. His wife's maiden name is Kathleen McBride. She's been sought for questioning. He last saw his daughter in 1968. He was charged with assaulting his ex-wife with a fishing knife, but there was evidently no record of his past other than that arrest. His last home was in Buena Park in Orange County, and his landlord's name was Walter Layton. We get that interesting can of worms again with London and Layton, and again I think of Mark Lane and Jonestown and Terry Buford and the Layton gang, because Tim Stone, involved with the financing of Jonestown and setting it up, went to London with contacts. And as I say, I think this was a nucleus of assassination teams moved from Mexico. And also, they were famous for writing confession notes that the assassins, there's 100 or 200 out still at large, could use. People had signed confessions for various murders. Dan Phillips, with money from Barclays Bank of Canada, was from England in 1973, helped set up Jonestown. And Debbie Layton, she married George Phillips Blakey, a person from London who skipped to the Barbados after Jim Jones and the 900 and more people were killed, is still at large. Terry Buford was in London with money, and Mark Lane still has Terry housed with him. There's the mystery of the London money to Jonestown. So you get a can of worms of an English connection here, going on, and the name Layton, the landlord's name, is Walter Layton down there in Orange County. Another coincidence, and no way to prove any connection on that one. On the other side of the tape, I want to do some more about the murder of Roy William Dale and just throw out what it possibly means. I'm not even sure myself, but I'm just telling you what the account was, and maybe more will come out later. The man whose home he lived in was managed by Walter Layton. I would bet from all the accounts that this had to be a CIA safe house down there in Buena Park in Orange County.